From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his big breakout book a decade and a half ago, Bill McKibben argued that the planet had come to the end of nature, that the very idea was going extinct. In his last book, Enough, he spoke with despair about where high tech was taking humankind. This time out, Bill McKibben is writing on a more intimate scale. He's seeing the world with an unmistakable streak of hope, and it's come from a long walk. For 3 weeks, he hiked west from his home in Vermont's Lake Champlain Valley to the Adirondacks in New York. He watched and listened for what is natural, what is local, what is still wild. And he came back with a spring in his step. Tonight on Point, Wandering Home with writer and environmentalist Bill McKibben. You can join the conversation. When did you last take a 200-mile hike, a 20-mile walk? And when you step out into the environment today, do you see cause for hope? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Middlebury, Vermont, is Bill McKibben, scholar-in-residence with the Department of Environmental Studies at Middlebury College. He's author of the best-selling The End of Nature and Enough, Staying Human in an Engineered Age. His new book is Wandering Home, a long walk across America's most hopeful landscape, Vermont's Champlain Valley and New York's Adirondacks. Bill McKibben, good evening, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Tom, what a pleasure to be with you.
It's terrific to have you. You've got a lot of ideas in here, as always. But I was really taken with your walk, and we kind of do want to get our hiking boots on and get into that groove with you, Bill, so that we can see the world as you were seeing it and ruminating on it in this long walk. Tell us about the hike you took.
Sure. You know, this was, in a way, for me, a vacation. I spend most of my life, you know, as you pointed out, kind of bringing bad news to people. And that gets wearing after a while.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, maybe a couple of years ago, a friend of mine at Random House said, oh, you know, we're doing this series of books on writers taking walks. And she started listing all the people who were doing them. And they were, you know, great writers. You know, Michael Cunningham was going to walk around Provincetown. And the late, great Frank Conroy was going to do a walk in Nantucket and things like that. And I said to her, you know, I'm not going to write a book quite as lyrical as any of these guys. On the other hand, I probably can walk further than they can. And so that's how this book was born. I've lived most of my adult life in the Adirondacks. I'm living over here on the other side of Lake Champlain now in the Middlebury area. And I figured it'd be a good way to spend part of the summer hiking between those two places, trying to show why it was that when I'm in a hopeful mood, it's because of where I live, what the stories are about how this place is being re-inhabited that I do think at least give us some reason to think that there are smarter ways to do things than we're doing them most of the time now.
So you joined those solitary tromping boots, the walks that have been taken in Chicago and Prague and Yellowstone and and Rome and Haiti and made one of your own in a fairly intimate setting, but a long walk, and one whose environs you knew very well. I want to stay with the walk for just a minute, because I have to say I really enjoyed just getting in those boots. You point out how it's different. You stayed at some friends along the way. This is territory you know well and a lot of people you know. You point out that it's different arriving on foot to someone's house from arriving in the sedan. I love that.
That's right. You know, when you sort of come for dinner at someone's house and you're there in the car, well, you're still sort of very much in the world. What are you talking about? You know, what you just heard on All Things Considered or something. But when you arrive on foot from a distance, it actually is quite striking. It's as if you're going to be there a while. It took you a while to get there, and you get some sense of what visiting must have been like in an age when people really did come for quite a while once they'd gotten someplace.
And you bring with you, you say, news not just off the radio or the newspaper, but news from the road. That is news from the physical world that you've been intimately walking through.
That's right. And one of the things you start realizing when you walk, I mean, you know, I'm used to hiking deep in the woods, and I love that, and part of this book is spent there. But I'm not so used to just walking down all the old back roads and things of the Champlain Valley. One of the things you start realizing is that a lot of stuff that appears flat and uninteresting at 60 miles an hour or even 45 is suddenly quite beautiful and interesting when you're wandering by it at walking pace.
And you're walking here through what you call two very different kingdoms of the imagination. Describe those for us. When you cross Lake Champlain, a road in an aluminum boat, I note, but when you cross that, you really are crossing from one world to another. It's a small corner of the country, but a big transition in states of mind and really even physical states.
That's right. It's a fascinating region, and the reason I think it's so hopeful is because the two sides of it have so much to say to each other. Vermont is the definition of pastoral. You know, all our images of what a pastoral New England landscape would look like, and the Champlain Valley is the quintessence of that, the great fertile agricultural valley really of all of New England. And in it, all these people doing such interesting things that I'm trying to write about, new small farmers and foresters and things like that. When you cross the lake, well, you've crossed out of New England. You're now into the West, you know, no more of those neat village greens with the white congregational church there at the end. All of a sudden, you're in the West in a lot of ways. The Adirondacks is a Western-scale wilderness. It's bigger than Glacier, Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, and Yosemite combined.
That astonished me, even though I've seen it on the map, just to have you put it that way.
It's everyone's astonished because, you know, American heads turn west when they think about wilderness. It's all Wyoming and Alaska and Montana. The exception to that is the Adirondacks, and it's in some ways even more magnificent because it's the largest example of ecological restoration on Earth, the biggest recovered wilderness. You know, 100 years ago, it was pretty much a clear-cut mess. Mm. And then the citizens of the state of New York, in a kind of a fever burst of early environmentalism long before the word had been coined, decided that they were going to set aside most of this land to be, in the words of the New York State Constitution, forever wild. And so now it's a great mix of wilderness and small hamlet communities. And if the Vermont side is teaching us a lot of lessons about husbandry and cooperation and that sort of thing, the Adirondack side of the lake is teaching us a lot of lessons about restraint, about taking a step back. There's very few places in the world that I know of where the pastoral and the wild butt up against each other quite this close. Hmm. And so it makes for magnificent contrasts.
So you're going from that cultivated land of husbandry to that wildness where, as you say, you're as near to Detroit as to Boston and out in some big, unruly territory. Now, I want you to begin to take us in to this hopeful tone that you've found here. And I hope it's not just because you are having a good time seeing friends on a long, lazy summer walk. I mean, I'm all for that. And believe me, I'm more and more for that. But I've read you outside the book, Bill McKibben, saying that for you, there's always been a kind of wistfulness at the core of your reaction to global warming, let's say. Always a kind of yearning to look for hope, even when things sometimes seem to be coming apart at the seam. Before you get down into those encouraging details of husbandry and Adirondack wildness, what's your big take on the environment today? Are you encouraged at the mega level or only when you get down to a nice little Vermont farm?
No, I'm sad to say that I think at the mega level there's not much at all to give us hope. Well, that says it too strongly, Tom. Hmm. In this country right now, there's a national level. There's nothing to give us hope environmentally. However, in other parts of the world, that's not as true. People have begun to step up to the plate on questions like global warming and started to do something about it. The bad news is that the science gets bleaker with each passing issue of science and nature, you know. And so it's very, very easy to be bleak. And certainly, you know, I mean, I'm no Pollyanna. I mean, I wrote a book called The End of Nature.
Yes, we noticed.
It doesn't get too much darker than that. On the other hand, it does seem to me that despair is a kind of useless place to spend too much time.
No kidding.
And it also seems to me that much of the trouble we're in is not necessary, that there are other ways we could be living that wouldn't exact the same kind of toll on the earth. And one gets at least a few hints of them in some of these places that I've been hanging out.
And we've got just a minute before the break, but to give us a taste of that, what you're really finding along your long hike, which is such a pleasure to accompany you on, Bill McKibben, is that smaller scale local agricultural husbandry, as you put it, whether in farming or forestry, people getting into a more intimate human scale relationship with nature. And in that, you see hope eventually, even on a large scale.
You know, the average bite of food in this country travels 1,500 miles before it reaches your lips. Basically, what do we do when we eat? We basically order takeout from the Central Valley of California, from Chile, from Mexico. To bring 1 calorie of iceberg lettuce east from California takes about 90 calories of fossil energy. If you're worried about things like climate change, those are big numbers. Parts of this country, 40% of truck traffic is involved in just moving food back and forth. And so it is really encouraging to see lots of people figuring out how they can shorten those supply lines, allow us to live closer to home. Not only is it fun to see, it also tastes incredibly good.
Bill McKibben, author of the new book, Wandering Home, he's with us tonight. We're taking a long walk with him, author of The End of Nature, now feeling a little hopeful. What do you think? You can join us tonight. Do you see a new wave of local agriculture, local forestry, local environmental awareness? Is it giving you hope? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are taking a long walk tonight with environmentalist and End of Nature author Bill McKibben, and he's feeling hopeful about ecology and agriculture getting local and maybe more. His new book is Wandering Home, A Long Walk Across America's Most Hopeful Landscape. You can join us tonight. When was the last time you walked 200 miles or 20 miles into the wild? And when you do stride out into the American environment today, are you feeling hopeful about the way humans and nature are getting along, about the way they might get along? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bill McKibben, I should say, it was just a week ago tonight, we had a really interesting conversation with a farmer in the Shenandoah Valley named Joel Salatin, who's very into sustainable agriculture, very much along the local lines that you're describing here. So it certainly, and we had calls from all around the country of people responding very vigorously to this and doing this, raising, you know, chickens in Washington State, the local or organic way, and right on around the country. So it's not only in the corner of New England into New York that you traverse, but give us a sense of, as you walked along those roads, what it was that you were seeing and stopping off to talk about that ended up putting the spring in your step.
Sure. One of the first places I stopped was in the Vermont town of Bristol, which is mostly forested. And there was a fellow there, a man named David Brin, who started a project years ago called Vermont Family Forests, maybe the most innovative attempt to bring ecological forestry to this part of the world, and the second half of the equation, to figure out how to make it pay so that people could afford to take good care of their land, so that people could afford to do a careful job of driving a skidder and hauling logs out and all those other really difficult tasks. And they've had a great deal of success. One of the ways they've had that success is by, and this is indicative of how much of, you know, our attitude toward the world is psychological. One of the ways they've been doing that is by convincing people to think differently about wood. Now, if you go and build a building, the architect will almost always specify in the plans that he wants grade one wood, no flaws or anything. Well, the only way to get trees like that is to do what a logger calls high grading, to take out all the biggest trees, straightest trees with no knots or anything in them, really to cull all the good trees out of the forest.
So this is not clear cutting anymore, but rather going in after those finest specimens in the woods.
Right. And instead, I mean, he was able to convince, say, Middlebury College, the local dominant, one of the dominant economic powers here, to do the interiors of their new buildings with this Vermont family forest wood and to reimagine what they once would have thought of as flaws in the wood as character. And so when you walk in and you see the interiors of these buildings, they're filled with the kind of fireplace flicker of, you know, whorls and knots and things. They're extremely beautiful. And that allows people to get a decent price for taking that wood out of the forest and for improving the forest ecologically.
So take that up to the big scale for us. What are you suggesting there? That you know how many new homes are built in America every year. You know all the 2x4s of white pine that are never seen again in behind the drywall. Do you see those coming out of family-tended forests around the country?
Structural lumber is going to be a longer take to figure out how to do this. And, of course, there are people beginning to do that on all kinds of scales, certified lumber and things. What was most interesting about this was to see the attention paid to making sure that there was a decent ability to pay a decent wage to the people who were doing this. Now, just like local food, it's not as easy for consumers to necessarily find or deal with this stuff. It takes a little more work, not always more money, but always a little more time. And that's the kind of price of being neighborly. And it's the price we've sort of forgotten how to pay in a kind of Walmart world, you know. But it's the price that we, I think, need to begin paying again. And one of the messages of this book is that it's a price that's great fun to pay, to begin to find out. I just finished a sort of compliment to this book, a piece that'll be in Gourmet later this summer, where I spent the whole winter just eating out of the Champlain Valley. No food from any place else.
Nothing flown in from Chile or...
Nothing that arrived on that 1,500-mile journey, you know, feeling kind of as wan as you do after a 1,500-mile journey. It was, you know, not only did it taste good like that, but everything that I ate had a story that came with it. I knew who had raised it. I met some of the animals I was eating, you know. It was food with real connection.
But was it just cabbage, potatoes, and Bessie?
No, there was all. I mean, Vermont, we have, you know, people trying everything.
Even in those cold winters.
Stuff that had been, for instance, and some of it quite, you know, high-tech in its way, like our apple warehouse here in the Champlain Valley. I mean, this is one of the great apple-growing regions in the world. But, you know, most of the apples in the supermarket come from New Zealand and from China. To try to defeat that, some of the local apple growers built a warehouse a few years ago that has some rooms that they can seal off. And they can pump out the oxygen and pump in a little nitrogen and so arrest the ripening of the apples. They open a new room every couple of weeks during the winter and, you know, you've got fresh eating apples and you've also got apples to put through the cider mill. And so there's fresh cider at the store now every week. I'm not going back to orange juice ever again. I mean, it was a revelation to be eating something that fresh all the time. So there are all kinds of things like that. Now, it doesn't, it doesn't happen overnight and it doesn't happen easily, but it is happening. If you looked around this country 15 years ago, you would have found about 400 farmers markets, something like that. Now there's approaching 10,000. It's booming because people are really, literally, and metaphorically hungry for some kind of more community and connection.
And there you're finding hope, though you do write about your friend David Brin, that with him, anything he's engaged in his case forestry, but the agriculture right next door, guaranteed to be a mix, in your words, of down-to-earth and pie in, as if you're about to say pie in the sky, and you say, well, pie hovering in midair, not yet quite in reach, but getting closer. And I wonder about that, because as you know, you're describing these wonderful nuggets, your experience that you saw along the road on your walk, your experience of eating locally through an entire Vermont winter. But you also say in another place where you've just gone by some giant McMansion, or maybe not Mick, just a mansion built by someone who's come in for maybe a second home, maybe a New Yorker enjoying Vermont. You say the scale of this region, herb farms, piano teaching, general stores, little libraries coexist uneasily with the high-octane national economy, and that hence the values and practices of community come inevitably up against the hyper-individualism of our time, the hyper-individualism that thinks nothing of ruining everyone else's view of the house four times too large for any conceivable purpose, and I guess you might add to that, thinks nothing of buying very good-looking fruit from Argentina or Chile or any part of the world. Do these things coexist with that larger culture?
You know, at the moment, it's clear that the larger culture is winning. The momentum of the Walmarts and the momentum of remains strong. On the other hand, I mean, you know, most of my work is, as you know, has been on these sort of global environmental problems, and I think it's probably only a matter of time before the some of the contradictions of the globalized world in which we live begin to catch up with us. As you know, there are people who think it's already happening as we reach some kind of peak oil state or something. I think it's entirely possible that in 10 or 15 or 20 years, we'll be needing to figure out how to live with shorter supply lines than we have now. I think at the moment we have this period of kind of grace to build those structures before we absolutely have to build them the right way, out of a sense of desire for more community. At the moment, it doesn't show up, you know, in the gross national product. It's not a huge force, but it's clearly a gathering and growing one. And I have some faith that it'll be one of the things that emerges from the strains of the planet that we're now experiencing.
And you saw a lot of it on that lovely long walk from Vermont into the Adirondacks. We're joined tonight by Bill McKibben. The End of Nature was his first big book, 1989. Now he's writing about Wandering Home, a long walk, 3 weeks, almost 200 miles, from a home in Vermont to a former home in the Adirondacks, two areas he knows well, and what he sees there gives him hope, gives him inspiration. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and a lot of callers want to join us, Bill. Let me turn to them. Gerard's calling from Traverse City, Michigan. Hi, Gerard, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom and Bill. Great show tonight. I wanted to say that, Bill, you could have taken this walk in northern Michigan and experienced the same type of hope. All we have up here is a return to so-called sustainable ag. I like to call it thriving agriculture because it's beyond sustainable. It is tonight we fed our family on fresh mix, salad mix, all organically grown, asparagus, organic sourdough bread, milk from cows who aren't on drugs but on grass, eggs fresh from the farm. I mean, it's all...
Hey, put another leaf on the table, Gerard. We're coming over.
We're ready. And the thing is that it's not inconvenient, it's not expensive, it's just the way it always was. And that's what makes Bill's story so unique, is that it's really just a few, you know, couple generations ago, that's how people ate.
So here's a fellow traveler, Bill, calling in from Traverse City. Jordan, let me ask you first, all this wonderful sounding food, is it from your own farm, or are you buying it from local farmers?
Well, right down the road, our local farm got off chemicals, went through a 10-step program, 12-step program, they're completely organic. And they have, you know, the whole range of products. They eat with hoop houses now. You can have four-season salads. And Bill, I'm sure, knows about this. You know, our local co-op, Oriana Co-op in Traverse City, has become a nexus of promoting local farmers. Their latest edition came in my mail today, the annual celebration of local farmers. And here's, you know, 15, 16 farms that weren't around 15, 16 years ago doing it quite like this, that are providing our local co-op with a huge growth, and it's just everyone's into it because there's nothing to be gained either nutritionally or spiritually from the Walmart food system.
Bill McKibben, here's a fellow traveler calling in from Michigan.
Let me tell you a story to sort of, you know, bump up this excitement even more. One of the happiest things for me was wandering into the Middlebury College organic garden, farm garden here. You know, Middlebury is a college like, you know, it's an elite, wonderful institution. But like most colleges, it hasn't really paid much attention to agriculture. All the other forms of culture, yes. But in a way, colleges were set up to get people off the farm. A few years ago, a few students decided that they wanted to have a garden here at the college. Well, it quickly grew into something much more than that. It's a kind of small farm, and it's supplying a lot of food to the college now. There are students, many students here that I've met who, you know, though they could go off and take every kind of, you know, trade bonds or, you know, sell stocks or all the other sort of plum jobs in our economy, instead they want to be small farmers, and they understand some of the price that goes with that, because it's not an easy or deeply profitable life if you measure your accounts solely in dollars.
But Bill, I've got to ask you about that, because as I read that, and I must say, I guess as you wrote it, you acknowledge this a bit too, but it did remind me a bit, and maybe I'm misguided here, but of, you know, the people 20, 30 years ago who were going to go off from college and start communes. Of course, they ended up being at Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, the difference is that these guys, to me, seem to be going into it with a good deal more. They're sort of clearer-eyed. One of the oddest things, I must say, about college students of this generation is that instead of just talking big, they're organized. They go out and do all the things that they set their minds to. And so, for instance, when these guys were starting this college garden here at Middlebury College, they not only spent days huddled with the dining service guys going over all the spreadsheets of what they could sell to them, they also spent days out with all the local farmers in the area, making sure that they weren't going to undercut their markets, you know, by growing things. They were picking crops that weren't growing otherwise. I think that there's – and it's very moving to watch sometimes older farmers who had begun to think that there was not going to be someone to pass on their knowledge to find out ways to do that, to see beekeepers training, 20-year-old college students how to take queen bees out of the hive and start a new colony, on and on and on.
And you're saying there just might be in this generation.
I think that it's a real – here anyway, it seems like a real possibility. And my sense is from hundreds of people like Jared that the same sort of dynamic is underway in a lot of places, and not just in rural America. In the suburbs too, and even in even downtown. I mean, New York City now has 15 or 20 farmers markets. One of them is the famous one at Union Square, the sort of green market with all the yuppie vegetables. But there are green markets like that in half the housing projects in New York City too, providing nutritious food at reasonable cost to people who really need it.
Gerard, you've got our appetites fired up, and yet I can't help wondering how you scale this up to really feed a country that does eat out of very large supermarkets overwhelmingly right now. Let's get another call. Frank is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Frank, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for entertaining my question. I live in Chapel Hill, in Carrboro, North Carolina, which is a very progressive area.
Sure.
We have a lot of people very concerned about buying locally, and a lot of people really opposed to the Walmart culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very easy for us to get locally grown food, get healthy food at a relatively reasonable price. But I know for a fact that Chapel Hill and Carrboro is not like much of the country. Most of the country is full of people who are quite literally living hand-to-mouth, people working 40, 50, 60, 70 hours a week, working two jobs. What can normal people do? Is there anything that a normal person can do in, say, the middle of the country that doesn't have access to all these resources? Because so many people who are interested in this kind of progressive lifestyle have a hard time realizing that most of the country is not like this. Most of the country is full of people who are just doing their best to pay the power bill and the water bill and run to the grocery store and grab food and can't even spare 5 minutes to go somewhere else to shop.
We're hearing from some happy corners tonight, but are there enough of them? We've got it, Frank, and thank you for your call. Bill McKibben, how about it? The whole country is not a Middlebury farm, that's for sure. Now, Gerard's saying in Michigan, hey, come on out, it's here. You're saying you found it on your long walk, but what about when you look out across the great expanse?
Well, you know, of the points that he made, I think in some ways the most telling one is that one about time crunch and how little time people have. And it is true that, you know, being a little more conscious of things does take a little more time, not a lot more money usually. I think that as people discover this kind of living, they find out that time is the great benefit of it, you know, that they're reestablishing those kind of connections with neighbors. And they find out that local economies thrive when this kind of stuff happens, when there's not the Walmart draining their money back to Arkansas, but instead it's recirculating close to home.
Back to Arkansas, back to China. Bill McKibben, stand by. The new book is Wandering Home. We're looking tonight at ecology and agriculture getting local. You can join us. Do you see a new wave of local agriculture, local forestry, local environmental awareness? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're taking a long walk tonight with environmentalist and end of nature author Bill McKibben, and he's feeling hopeful about a world, and we'll come to this, that has both tall pines and Burger Kings. Paris, the thought, I'd never thought I'd hear it from Bill McKibben, but it's there. His new book is Wandering Home, A Long Walk Across America's Most Hopeful Landscape, Vermont's Champlain Valley and New York's Adirondacks. You can join us tonight. What do you hear in the new ruminations of Bill McKibben? And what's your own evolving understanding of how nature and human nature might realistically, optimistically intersect? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. There's some interesting notes in here, Bill, that were kind of new to me. Maybe you've been dropping these all along. But first, your readiness. Well, one which was kind of fun. You stayed with Don and Cheryl, friends at one point in Vermont. Don's been writing a book in which he kind of goes after environmentalists, really having some fun at their expense, almost sounding anti-environmentalist. And you're quoting him with a kind of relish that I never expected from the end of world guy about how, you know, they're I don't have the words right in front of me now, but they're, you know, self-absorbed, they're effete, they're almost the nature writing that's almost autoerotic. I'm not even sure what that meant. Have you taken on a kind of a, I don't know, touch of jaundice here, Mr. McKibben?
No, not me, but this is my good friend Don Mitchell, who's a wonderful writer. And who's written a new novel called The Nature Notebooks, I think, is the title of it. And it is a pretty caustic look at some of the kind of excesses of the, nature. There is a little bit of kind of bad nature writing out there, it must be said. And
self-absorbed, self-congratulatory, and vaguely autoerotic. Okay.
His words, not mine, yeah, but it's a It's you know, at this point, one of the things we sort of realize, I think, and have realized more and more in the last few years thinking about environmentalism, is that when it comes to topics like global warming, it's really impossible for this thing we call environmentalism to handle these issues. It doesn't make sense, really, to sort of assign them to environmentalism. They're so enormous that they're at least as much questions of national security, of economics, of psychology, of all these other things. And there is a sense, I think, in which environmentalists at a certain level have had to lighten up a little bit. Someone said not long ago, environmentalists are really good at giving this speech that begins, "I have a nightmare,"
Right.
There's a reason that wasn't the one that Martin Luther King gave, you know.
Mm. And you say, you talk about the idea of reconciliation between the wild and the pastoral. This, again, it kind of read like an evolution of Bill McKibben to me. So it's not entirely new, but that there's this increasingly sophisticated sense of the scale of environmental problems, that protecting wilderness in Vermont or anywhere else is not really an answer if it leads directly to the destruction of forests somewhere else for paper-hungry world. So you're saying, let's get into husbandry. Let's, as environmentalists, let's not be opposed to going out and working that land, working it knowledgeably, acknowledging it won't be just wild nature, and that's all right.
You know, for me, one of the great mentors, exemplars, has been Wendell Berry, the wonderful Kentucky farmer, essayist, novelist, poet, who's always stressed that, one of his first books was called Home Economics, stressed that without being able to take good care of the land that we were using, there'd be no hope of having other land that we could leave aside. he and Ed Abbey, the other, the Southwestern desert rat, mm-hmm. anarchist environmentalist, they were the two writers when I was a young man that were sort of my lodestones. And I'm extremely lucky to live in a place where both of their senses of the world can be experienced daily and experienced not as contrasts but as things that fit together, the wild and left alone places and the cultivated places where we're finally beginning to take good care of the land that we're using instead of treating it as a commodity.
We've got a mountain of callers who want to join us. Let's turn to them. Ginger's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Ginger. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I was just calling to comment. Thank you for taking my call. And I read
sure.
Hope, Human and Wild a few years ago, and it was great, and it really gave me hope. And I think that on one hand, I have seen, and I am seeing, a wave of environmentalism or more sustainable ways of living with sustainable forestry and agriculture and that kind of thing. I used to work in southeastern Ohio for this organization. It's a rural development organization called Rural Action. And working there and throughout central Appalachia and southern Appalachia, I saw a lot of that, and it was really inspiring and uplifting. But then I moved back to Raleigh, North Carolina, and I know I heard the guy call from Chapel Hill, and there is still a lot, I realize, a lot of sustainable agriculture and sustainable forestry and great practices going on around here and progressive people. But at the same time, we live in an area where air quality is horrible, and you know, we just reached non-attainment through the Air Quality Division of Air Quality, and that means... we're hurting ourselves, and that means that our air is unhealthy. And I see, you know, high rise after high rise.
Just not feeling like nirvana to you there yet.
Yeah, not at all. And then Bill was talking about how global warming and things like that are more of a you can't look at it all just from the environmental standpoint or just as environmentalism. But at the same time, air quality is something that we can each do something, one person can do something to improve that, and we're not doing that here in this area. And so I'd like to hear Bill's comments about that and just how I can, aside from just reading Hope, Human, and Wild over and over again, how I can still remain hopeful.
It sounds like Ginger's worried that you know, there aren't enough farmers' markets to deal with the big picture.
I'm not here... announcing, you know, sort of handicapping a race. I don't know how it's all going to come out. I'm sort of trying to suggest that there are things we could be doing that would make a difference and that doing them would be deeply pleasurable, too, that they are places where we all can start. Now, I agree with her. I think it's entirely possible that this is a battle that may not be won in the end, or that there are going to be an awful lot of losses along the way. The way that our country, for instance, is behaving now internationally with regard to all these environmental questions is shameful. The country that was invented environmentalism and that led the world for 100 years is now a pariah nation at every international conference to discuss things like global warming or air quality or any of these other central issues. I mean, you know, the Chinese last month adopted auto efficiency standards way better than ours. These are deep, deep questions, and these are where I spend most of my time working. But the things that keep me working are the sense that there really are alternatives that work, and that work especially for working people, not for, you know, rich people, but for people who are or can be able to have some tie to the land. You know, at this point in America, there are fewer full-time farmers than there are prison inmates. That's not a good number, in my opinion. And I'm very hopeful at some of the signs that that's beginning to change.
Hopeful that it might change and willing, as you write, to see signs of industry along signs of wildness out there, if it's the kind of industry that you like the looks of.
Well, of course. I mean, industry of all kinds, you know, economic activity of all kinds conducted on a scale that makes sense. That's clearly what we need. And at the moment, that's not what we're getting. At the moment, what we're seeing happen is too much of the rest of the world following us down precisely the same path that we've pretty much proven isn't going to work very well for the world. I mean, the Chinese are adding Southern California's electric generating capacity to their grid every year, all of it fired by coal. That's a scary number. There are a lot of scary numbers. And all the more reason, then, to start looking for some things that now or in the future may give us something to fall back into.
Maura's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Maura. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Tom, I have an answer to your initial question, and then I have a thank you for Bill. You asked when was the last time you walked 200 miles.
Yes, I did. Have you got a reply to that one?
I do. I did a 230-mile stretch on the Appalachian Trail two summers ago somewhat in Bill's neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I started in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, walked all the way through Vermont up to Hanover, New Hampshire. And Bill's comments on arriving on foot are so incredibly on. They are dead on.
Doesn't that bring all the endorphins back to remember what that's like, not to just come screeching up in a car, but to come after a good long exertion along the road?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I wanted to thank you for having this program tonight, and especially to thank Bill, because, I mean, I buy organic. A lot of us in Madison, Wisconsin do. We buy free range and local, but it's so disheartening sometimes to hear the global picture. But this type of show encourages us that you have to start somewhere, and hearing all these people call and say that this is happening, even if it's in small pockets, pockets grow and they rip and things leak out, and they can, you know, this can really travel around, and it's a great message to put out.
Maura, it's wonderful to hear about that great hike. It's terrific. Thank you very much for your call. Our time's short, Bill. I'm looking here just at the last page of the book, where I'm going to read just a bit. I don't know if you do you have it, the book, in front of you?
I do, in fact.
Oh, great.
It in front of me.
Much better if you read it then. Just take us to this last page where you, where you take us into the world you walked across.
Sure. This is how it ends. I have the great good fortune to have found the place I was supposed to inhabit, a place in whose largeness I can sense the whole world, but yet is small enough for me to comprehend. If, when it comes my turn to die, I really do see again that view from Mount Abe, and this is where the book began, with this vision from the top of this mountain of rainbow upon rainbow and things, I know that that view will contain all these things: farm, field, forest, mountain, loon, moose, cow, monarch, pine, hemlock, white oak, shepherd, bee, beekeeper, college, teacher, beaver flow, bakery, brewery, hawk, vineyard, high rock, high summer, deep winter, deep economy. Yes, and cell phone tower, and highway, and car lot, and Burger King. This is part of the real world. But what's rare sometimes in that real world, and more common here, is the chance for completion, for being big sometimes and small at others, in the shadow of the mountains and in the shade of the hemlocks.
With the 1 minute we've got, tell us about that completion. What is it?
You know, much of my work is about the sense and the fact that in many ways the world is spinning apart. The trends, as people have been pointing out, of all kinds are kind of unstoppable and grim. That's why in place after place, it's so wonderful to have at least some slight sense that instead, in these local places with local economies, with people becoming neighbors again, that things are starting to cohere, that the world is threatening to make a certain kind of sense once in a while. And it's that search for a kind of sense that guides most of my work these days.
Bill McKibben's new book is Wandering Home, A Long Walk Across America's Most Hopeful Landscape, Vermont's Champlain Valley and New York's Adirondacks. Bill, thanks for taking us along on a bit of that walk with you tonight. Wonderful to have you on. Thanks so much,
Tom,
for joining us.
Could not have enjoyed it more. Thank you so much.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, we'll hear from the first African-American to head a major conservation organization. This is On Point. Growing up in southern Louisiana, Jerome Ringo spent a lot of time outdoors, hunting and fishing. As a top-tier Boy Scout, he was often the first and only African-American stepping up for special honors. In 1998, he was the only African-American delegate at the Global Warming Treaty negotiations in Kyoto, Japan. Last month, he was sworn in as the chairman of the National Wildlife Federation, the first African-American to chair a major conservation organization. Here, Jerome Ringo describes how he became an environmentalist.
I worked in the petrochemical industry in Louisiana, which is the largest employer in our state. I went to work not long after high school, and it was not uncommon that during the summer months, college students would come home for the summer and go to work in the petrochemical plants. I became very aware of some of the adverse impacts of petrochemical industries on people's lives soon after going to work in the plant. I always recognized the economic impacts of the industry, the fact that they provided jobs, they provided very needed products that we use on a daily basis. But passing and driving through neighborhoods on my way to work, I recognized that there were people that lived in closest proximity to those plants that were disproportionately impacted. I guess the turning point more was a conscience issue, realizing that there was certain protections required of us as workers within the fence line of the plant. We wore special fireproof clothing. We wore respirators to protect us from gas leaks. And I realized that people just outside the fence line did not get that same protection. I guess some believe that the chain link fences would stop the gas. Unfortunately, that was not the case. And I became very concerned. I became concerned when I realized that there were homes within 50 feet of our plant gate that were not given the same protection that was given inside the fence line. It's a proven fact that people of color communities per capita have a greater interest in environmental issues than non-color communities. People of color care about the environment. Unfortunately, they don't have the resources to go out and fight the battles like those that do have the resources. And I think the greatest resource to poor people and people of color to get involved in this movement is education. And that is the focus that is going to preserve this earth for decades to come. My responsibility, I believe, is to leave a footprint in the sand for other people who may have felt in the past disconnected from the movement, that they now can be and should be connected. And I believe that the face of the conservation movement must change and will change. And I'm very optimistic about that.
Jerome Ringo is chairman of the National Wildlife Federation. He spoke with us from Lafayette, Louisiana. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.